It is Friday, September 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, migrants continue to stream into Europe, seeking refuge from violence in the Middle East. We'll talk with our correspondent in Serbia. Singapore voters cast ballots in parliamentary elections.
I think the real question here is, you know, how strong is the PAP's mandate? You know, will it see its electoral support erode even further?
And plans are announced for the next Super Bowl halftime musical performance. It's all ahead. Migrants from the Middle East are continuing to travel into Europe seeking refuge from the violence. I'm joined now by VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim, who's in Belgrade, Serbia. Aisha, what is the refugee situation like where you are now?
It seems like the situation here has stabilized. Thousands of migrants, as you say, are coming here. We just talked to a humanitarian organization, ADRA, a national organization that's helping relief efforts, and they say 600 to 1,000 people are coming every day. That's around 3,000 a month. This has dropped down significantly from 2 or 3 weeks ago when Macedonia closed the border, and when it opened again, there was a huge rush of people. So now the relief agencies here seem to have enough supplies. The biggest problem they're facing and what the migrants are facing is language barriers, because we see constantly migrants trying to talk to relief workers or volunteers and them trying to talk back, and nobody understands each other. That was happening at the Red Cross camp. That's what we saw in Hungary, in the Budapest station. That's what we saw at the border crossing from Serbia to Hungary. It's an information gap, literally, because one, the migrants mostly speak either Arabic or Pashto, and most officials here, volunteers, do not speak those languages. And that's creating a lot of confusion.
When the refugees arrive in Serbia, where do they go? Are they able to stay there for a while, or are they immediately sent out of the country?
Well, they usually come to Belgrade, and a lot of them, I'm standing in the middle of a park where a lot of refugees gather, because as soon as they get off the trains, they see refugees and migrants here. This is where they come. This is where the aid camp is set up. Nobody pushes them out. I think there's kind of a feeling in Serbia that these people are just passing through. They're not here to stay. Unlike Hungary, where people fear that those refugees might stay in Hungary, or if they their asylum applications in other countries are not accepted, that they'll come back to Hungary. Unlike that, Serbia, there's the feeling that this is a transit zone, so people seem to be okay with them passing through. We saw the bus company officials, not a government bus company, but a private company right next to the park, giving out information leaflets in Arabic to the migrants. I talked to them. They said they were trying to help them so nobody could cheat them off of fares, etc. So usually they come here and either leave the same day or they stay here for 2 or 3 days and then move on. Most of them want to get to the border of Serbia and Hungary and move on from there into Hungary to Budapest, and then they want to move on to Germany, Sweden, or other countries in Western Europe. A lot of these migrants, several of them, particularly coming from Syria, have some resources, some money, so when they get here, some of them buy stuff. But there's a lot of relief camps and set up here to give them food, clothing, winter clothing. It's raining here, so rain gear. And just their tents set up all around the park, where if somebody has to spend the night, they can spend the night. I can see tents occupied by families, by children. So basically, they come and spend here a few days here and then move on to Hungary.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Aisha, for speaking with me today. That is VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim reporting from Belgrade, Serbia. Among the situations involving refugees in Europe along the Hungarian-Austrian-Serbian border, there are stories that some of these refugees have been able to be helped by social media. I'm joined now by VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard, who's been doing some reporting on this. Doug, what have you found about how social media can help some of these people?
Hi, Sarah. Well, first off, there are the individuals themselves, those tens of thousands of refugees who are undertaking this arduous journey and encountering all kinds of problems along the way. What we're seeing, we've seen this before, but what we're really seeing on display this time is how these refugees are very dependent on social media. Believe it or not, not only do they need food, water, shelter, that kind of thing, but they need Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp. So they're using these things to keep in touch with family members who may be in different parts of a nation or different nations. They're using them to share information about border guard movements and that kind of thing. So these social media are, as we see, being used by refugees themselves to help themselves. But also, interestingly, the emergency preparedness community and public health officials across the region, in the Middle East and in Europe, are increasingly also turning to social media and networking to try and better direct aid to where it's most immediately needed.
And why is social media more successful in that than, say, more traditional methods?
Sure. Well, I think, first off, because it's so immediate. People who are tweeting their location, perhaps sending photos, sending messages, information, it all creates what they call a very hot map. It's real time, and anybody's really able to kind of collect this information and assemble a, you know, like an up-to-the-moment map of where people are, what's going on, that's happening. I think another aspect of that is that we saw this in the tsunami following the Japanese earthquake. Traditional lines of communication went down. Phones went down. Other, you know, means of communication went down, radio and television. But what stayed fairly robust, actually, was the online stuff, Skype, Facebook, Twitter. And authorities were able to collect that information and use it. So I think social media's strengths are that it is relatively robust, as long as you can keep your device charged, and that it is so immediate.
Well, that's true, but it's kind of amazing thinking these people who have nothing or very little, that they're able to still use, say, smartphones, and as you said, to keep them charged.
Exactly. It doesn't really, I think, compute to some of our minds when you think of the refugees, and of course, the very real immediate human needs that they have: diapers, water, clean water, food, that kind of thing. But increasingly, we are really seeing, I think, perhaps on display more in this crisis than we've ever seen before, that these apps and electronic means of communication are really a lifeline for the refugees.
All right. Thanks very much, Doug. That's VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard. Well, speaking of social media, joining me here in the studio is our very own social media editor, Andrew Palshevsky. Andrew, what is the continuing reaction to this refugee crisis in Europe?
Well, as we were just talking about and reacting to Doug's piece, you see all these pictures coming out now of people with chargers, and they put adapters on the chargers to make it even more plugs for more chargers. And that really speaks to what Doug's talking about, that it really is a lifeline for these refugees as they're coming over, the social media, either connecting with folks or reaching back to family. So it's interesting you're seeing a lot of these photos and people slowly beginning to realize what an impact social media is having in this case. Today here in the U.S., of course, is the 14th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks. And so worldwide, the top two or three trending topics are all related to 9/11. And in the U.S., the top five or six are all different. Hashtag never forget 9/11, hashtag September 11, hashtag God bless America, hashtag honor 9/11. So a lot of different hashtags for that. And people are using them in a lot of different ways. You have a lot of remembrances, of course, general remembrances, remember all the victims and nearly 3,000 people that died. Specific people talking about family members that they lost. You also had interesting stories about people saying, I remember where I was 14 years ago today. I was on the subway and I was about to go up to my office and in the World Trade Center, and thank God I was able to get out. So a lot of survivor stories as well. And then you have Ari Fleischer. Now, this is an interesting story, I think. Ari Fleischer was the press secretary for President George W. Bush on 9/11. He was with the president as he was traveling around the country trying to get back to the D.C. area. And Ari Fleischer last year did this thing on Twitter. He live tweeted and kind of recounted every moment where he was on September 11th. So he would say, you know, we took off from such and such a base and arrived at such and such a place, which were all classified information at the time, but now he can reveal this. And people were following along, retweeting thousands of retweets for this. So he said that he's going to do something similar today. I don't know if he's going to do a full live tweet of every moment, but he's going to share some photos and things. But an interesting way to remember that day and kind of give a historical view of one of the people who was there right as it was happening.
Yeah, very interesting. And for people that were, you know, a little young at the time, maybe they can really, you know, see what happened as it took place.
Well, that's what they're saying, that the high school freshmen that just entered the first year of high school this year were either just born or hadn't been born yet when the September 11th attacks happened. So it's interesting that this is the social media generation. This is how they're going to learn about this, is through other people's stories and social media. It's kind of a living history.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, thank you very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Earlier this year, the mysterious bright spots that were spotted on the dwarf planet Ceres stoked the imagination of people everywhere. Now, NASA has released some new high-detail images of those bright spots that were captured by its Dawn spacecraft. The brightest of these mysterious spots are located within the Oculator crater on Ceres. NASA says that these newly released images are giving scientists the closest view yet of the crater and are providing a unique and better understanding of the strange features on the dwarf planet. Since the mysterious spots are much brighter than the surrounding landscape, the Dawn project team actually had to produce composites that were made up of two separate images at the proper exposure for its surroundings. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the Super Bowl's halftime musical plans are announced. Singapore voters cast ballots Friday in snap elections called by the ruling People's Action Party, or PAP. Members of the opposition hope the poll will boost their presence in the 89-member parliament, thus challenging the PAP's half-century hold on power. Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong called for the election 16 months ahead of schedule in search of a new mandate following the death in March of the city-state's founder and longtime leader, Lee Kuan Yew. He is the current leader's father. The issues of immigration, the cost of living, and social welfare benefits for the poor and elderly were major campaign themes. All issues fueled growing popular interest in the opposition, although the ruling party's hold on power appears not to be in question. International Edition's Victor Viti spoke with political analyst Eugene Tan, who says following the loss of seats in the 2011 election and a drop of electoral support of the PAP to 60%, the question is, can the opposition make further inroads in parliament?
I think the real question here is, you know, how strong is the PAP's mandate. You know, will it see its electoral support erode even further? And we must remember that in the last general election in 2011, the People's Action Party turned in its worst electoral performance since independence. If we see political support for the PAP eroding further, I think that could also be seen as that there is being momentum generated for Singapore to move away from being a one-party dominant system.
This is the first election without independence leader Lee Kuan Yew.
He passed away in March, but he's never far from the campaign over the last 9 days. Both the opposition as well as the ruling parties have sought to remind voters, you know, about Mr. Lee Kuan Yew. You know, for the opposition is about how the current ruling party, the party which Mr. Lee Kuan Yew founded, you know, it's not the PAP that Singaporeans knew from the 60s, 70s and 80s and maybe even the 90s. And for the ruling party, you know, they have sought to invoke, the memory and of Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, you know, by pointing out that theirs is a party that has kept faith with Singaporeans, you know, since independence. And in fact, even all the way back to 1959 when Singapore gained self-government, it's interesting that, you know, much as he's no longer with us, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew is pretty much in the play.
Immigration is a big issue in U.S. politics. I would imagine it's perhaps in some ways an even bigger issue in Singapore.
Yes, it is. I know, because Singapore has seen its population grow significantly, easily 20% over the last decade, primarily driven by immigration, both short-term and long-term. And I think, the immigration is seen as the cause for many of the unhappiness for Singaporeans, whether it's cost of living issues, whether it's housing affordability, whether it's the public infrastructure inadequacy, to the dilution of national identity concerns over that. So it's very much in the mix. And I think, the election rallies, the party's manifestos have devoted a lot of time to the issue of immigration.
If the opposition does not foresee a victory, what do they hope to accomplish?
I think certainly the opposition would like to see electoral support, for the ruling People's Action Party being eroded. But I believe that the opposition parties, they have had generally a good campaign. The PAP hasn't campaigned as well as it should over the last 9 days. And I think the opposition parties are relatively confident, that they would be able to make gains in this particular general election.
That's Eugene Tan. He's a political analyst in Singapore. Preliminary results are expected at about 10 p.m. local time. This is VOA.
I'm Nilar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. The U.S. National Football League's Super Bowl game is often one of the highest-rated television programs each year, and the halftime show is as much a part of the program as the competition on the field. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about who will headline the halftime show at Super Bowl 50 on February 7th.
The Super Bowl halftime show has become a big part of the game itself. And now the man who was on it just a few years ago is going to be doing that show for the 50th Super Bowl in February. Shauna, Bruno Mars has been on this before. It was just a couple of years ago.
Yes.
And now for the Super Bowl 50 in 2016, he's not only the act, but he's also supposed to curate the show.
That's what we're hearing. So Billboard.com confirmed that sources have said that he's been asked to do it. Now, he has not agreed to do it. At least we don't know that. But yes, he is going to curate it. Now, from what I understand, that means that he will be a part of it, but he will also be responsible for bringing guests on. Now, you might remember when he performed during Super Bowl 48, he brought on the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And that's not uncommon. Very often when an artist will come and do the Super Bowl, they'll bring their friends. Katy Perry brought out Missy Elliott, and Madonna brought out Nicki Minaj and MIA some years ago. So it'll be very interesting to see what he does. He's a consummate performer, and I don't believe he will expect anything less from the people that he brings on. So if he says yes, and I think he will, this is going to be an awesome halftime show.
This is that ice cold Michelle fight for that white gold. This one for them hood girls, them good girls, straight masterpieces. Stylin', wildin', living it up in the city. Got Chucks on with Saint Laurent, gotta kiss myself, I'm so pretty. I'm too hot.
Well, plus literally billions of people worldwide watch this particular show.
Mm-hmm.
They watch the game, but the halftime show is as much
a part of watching the game as watching the actual competition on the field.
Right.
So, you know.
And for folks like me who couldn't care less about football, it is the reason why you watch the Super Bowl. So, yes, it is a very important part of the show.
And Bruno Mars also had a number one hit. He broke the record for having the consecutive weeks at number one with Uptown Funk.
Yeah, he and Mark Ronson with Uptown Funk. And so he obviously is someone that is adored and adored by fans and well-respected in the music industry. So it does make sense. And up until that point, he had had the highest viewed halftime show for the Super Bowl. Katy Perry broke the record the next year, but he held that record. He's, like I said, consummate performer. Never expect anything less than fantastic.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Super Bowl 50 is the first Sunday in February. You can look for Bruno Mars on the halftime show. You can also look for Shauna Renee on the VOA Soul Lounge. That's on our website, voanews.com. If you want to send her a tweet, she is at VOA Lady DJ.
A lot of people looking forward to that Super Bowl game as well as the halftime. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political violence shows no easing in Burundi with the murder of an opposition party spokesman in the capital, Bujumbura. Patrice Gangu of the UPD Zigamibanga party was shot and killed outside his home September 7th, the second top official of the group slain in the turmoil surrounding President Pierre Nkurunziza's controversial decision to run for a third term. Other prominent Burundians have been gunned down in recent months as well, with no suspects arrested. 15 years ago, the spirit of the Arusha Agreement transformed Burundi by enshrining the conviction that the government must represent and serve all citizens. Today, Burundi faces a renewed challenge to end violence and achieve lasting stability by coming together in the spirit of Arusha. This isn't the work of one group, but of every person and party. We call on President Nkurunziza and his government, on opposition leaders, and on all the people of Burundi to join now in an open, comprehensive, and representative national dialogue. Nor is it a challenge for Burundi alone. The United States reiterates its support for regional leadership, including Uganda and the East African Community, to convene and mediate a political dialogue and urges them to do so soonest. High-level engagement by the African Union and the United Nations and positive action by all states in the region is critical to bring Burundi back from the brink. We also remain committed to holding accountable human rights violators and abusers and all those who seek to undermine stability in Burundi. President Nkurunziza is well aware of his nation's crisis and has called for security committees to work together with Burundi's security agencies. That is very worrisome, as it includes armed youth militia, including the armed contingent of the Imbonerakure, the ruling party's youth wing. Militia violence and intimidation have profoundly increased tensions and worsened a crisis that has driven almost 200,000 Burundians to take refuge abroad. To prevent further violence, armed Imbonerakure and all militias must be disarmed immediately, with AU oversight. We call on all Burundians to oppose any further acts of unlawful violence and to join together now in the spirit of Arusha to reach consensus and a peaceful path forward for Burundi.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.